Daddy, what are you doing?
I'm doing a podcast, Dizzy.
Hello and welcome to the Too Cool for School podcast. I'm your host, Yannick, and on today's episode, we are exploring what it means to learn, but not just in the classrooms, but through culture, through community, and through challenges. And on today's episode, I've got a special guest who has lived at the intersection of all three and has shown that, you know, our journey through education is not always linear. So I'll allow my special guest to introduce himself.
Yes, yes. Respect, Yannick, and the team. Myself, George, the poet. Thank you very much for having me on.
Okay, great stuff. So, George, I wanted to start off just by asking, you know, you've often spoke about the sort of disconnect between, like, your upbringing and the academic environments that you grew up in. And I wanted to sort of start off by kicking off with, like, how did you navigate, you know, that gap? And what do you think schools can be doing to really consider the cultural background that their students are coming from when they enter education?
Yes, thank you for that question. So, growing up, we're from a Ugandan home, but we were in a predominantly Jamaican neighborhood, and our schools, obviously, they're mainstream English schools, so there's a certain ideology they come with. But shout out to all my primary schools and my neighborhood in general, because it was a very diverse experience as a child. We learned how to say hello in everyone else's language, and we learned how to mix and learn from everyone else's culture quite early. But then I get to secondary school, and it's diverse in a different way, just different demographics. Instead of it being Jamaican and Somali youths, it's more South Asian, Indian, Tamil, East Asian, Korean, Chinese. And that was the culture of the school itself was also very different from the culture of my primary school. It was old school. It was like establishment Britain. It felt like a private school, but it was a grammar school. Mm. And it was very competitive, because being a grammar school, you got to do an exam to get in. So all the kids have already shown a certain level, and, you know, some of them have been tutored from when they were 3 years old, and some of them just have a very different lifestyle from me. You know, I was used to being around in the estate with my people, and some of them just weren't really allowed out like that in their early years. Then I get to Cambridge by the time I'm in uni, and it wasn't diverse. They weren't that diverse. It was very much a white institution. But there's also the same level of academic intensity that I had been primed for a long time. So what has been my experience is that the further I progress in education, the further distance I am from the community that I started in. And it becomes more of a fight to keep that community at the center of my academic journey as a humanities student.
Mm. No, that's very insightful. And I want to reflect a bit about you going to Cambridge. What made you even apply for that? And I asked that in a sense where when I was in school, you know, sixth form, and I would consider myself, you know, an above average student, and I had, you know, colleagues who were smart and did very well in terms of A-levels. But Cambridge and Oxford just seemed like, you know what, that's not for us. Like, we just, there was just like this culture, this environment of, that's not for us. You've got to be a different level, or you've got to be a different shade of skin. We just didn't see ourselves, you know, having even the aspirations to even consider applying for those places. So what was it for you at that stage that made you feel like, yeah, I'm going to apply for there?
So the whole back and forth between the community that we grew up in versus the world, the cultural world that we were from. Mm. So I wasn't the first in my family to go to Uxbridge. you know, my grandfather went and studied at Oxford for a little bit. My uncle, my auntie, they'd all, like, you know, been either in Russell Group universities or Ivy League. I had an uncle that went to Harvard.
Wow.
So to be honest with you, it was expected within my family that I was going to reach for the stars academically, yeah? That's how it was framed to us from a young age. But then, yeah, like, in my neighborhood, no one really knew where I was going or, like, what it meant to go to Cambridge. Or even in my dad's workplace, they were like, so the exact same words you just said, that's not really for us. Why are you sending them there?
Mm.
You feel me? So there's always this back and forth between being black in the West versus coming from a African background that is a little bit more, what's the word? I don't know. Maybe aspirational.
Mm.
I don't even want to say that because it sounds like I'm talking down on the community, but I write about this in my book. Yeah. Last year, I released a book called Track Record, and a lot of it is my life story. And towards the end, I'm summarizing, I explain that a lot of the privileges that I was able to tap into as a young man, they started generations before me, and it's complicated because they come from my grandparents happening to, like, reap the benefits of the British Empire.
So I wanted to sort of continuing from that conversation. One of the things that I'm conscious of, and I asked earlier about, you know, should educators, you know, how much should educators consider the cultural background of the students, you know, that go to the school. And because if I'm thinking, you know, for many of us who have come from, you know, maybe marginalized, you know, community or disadvantaged communities, etc., and, you know, we have those aspirational goals to do better academically, should schools consider, you know, those students and think about it in terms of, like, that equity versus equality conversation and say, actually, they're from more, like, deprived backgrounds, so we need to pour more into them rather than offering everyone else, like, an equal playing field, in a sense?
I mean, I think in some schools there's an element of that. I remember one time me and my friend from Tottenham in Cambridge, a sister called Cheyenne, we're like, obviously, both from kind of ends. And she said to our director of studies, would that have been taken into account, the fact that we were admitted into this uni and we're from these lower income working class backgrounds? And our director of studies in Cambridge said, yeah, to be honest, we consider that. We look at everything. Now, I don't really know what the method is. I don't know how they weighed up what. And but one thing I did think was, like, fair enough for Cambridge, but for schools, that's leaving it quite late. Schools need to be a bit more, I don't know, I'm not in the school system, but I would hope that schools are actively seeking out young people that are from backgrounds that don't traditionally have the structural support, and ensuring that they are able to get ahead. 'Cause, yeah, going back to the equity thing, that's what it's about, making sure that the structural disadvantages that they're facing are accounted for.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. I remember, I don't think they still did it now, but I remember back in the days, because I'm 34, going to be 35 in November, and I remember being in school and they used to, what did they used to call it, like gifted and talented. They had, like, gifted and talented for, like, the different,
yeah, you remember,
yeah, for, like, the different subjects. And, you know, you'll either get taken to, you know, either, like, a different school to do, like, projects with other schools who are where students were of like a certain caliber in like maths or gifted in the arts or whatever that may be. But I don't think they still, I don't think they still have that. So that's actually an interesting point, and you know, it's a good, and for any of the educators that are locked in listening to this, especially, you know, senior leadership level, head teachers, etc., is definitely something to, you know, for them to consider. And I also wanted to know, like, from your experience growing up versus what you've seen in the community of recent, what do you think's like the biggest challenges facing like marginalized community that essentially impacts the upbringing and the education like of the youth? Like, what was the biggest challenges you faced like when you was in school, and what do you see as the biggest challenges, you know, currently? And it could be that, you know what, I went to school how long ago and nothing's really changed, or it could be that you've seen a change. So it'd be good to get, you know, that insight from you as well.
I'll say, bro, I'll give you an answer that I've never given anyone before, because it's kind of something that I've realized over the past 3-4 years. We are educated out of our community. We're not educated back into it. So the people like yourself and myself that show a bit of educational promise and are fortunate enough to have a productive career in school, there's very little education there's very little provision that reorients us back into the community. Some of my peers did teach first, and that was their way of getting back in, and they did very well. They did even better than me in school and university, but they committed their lives to going back and teaching. But as someone that really studied sociology, I studied the sociology of education for a bit. I think it's what I am noticing is that those of us who are fortunate enough to do well in school and university, we are educated to go and leave the community and not think critically about the challenges of the community and the way that those challenges can be broken. And I say community, but I mean it in the biggest, broadest sense possible. I'm talking about the working class generally. I'm talking about Afro-descended people generally. I describe my journey, how I went from a local primary school to a suburban grammar school for my secondary years. And then I went to Cambridge University. And as I said earlier, at every stage, I got further and further away from the community. But it's only because I have a connection to the community that I guess my poetry maintained. So the more I'm talking about community issues, the more I'm thinking like, nah, even though I've spent all this time in academia, I still don't really understand what's going on. So that alone pushed me to go on my own journey, read my own books, kind of forget everything that I learned in school and just look at the situation with a little bit of independent learning. And that's why I'm able to come back and have some ideas about how, from a cultural perspective, I can contribute to promoting a deeper understanding of working class Pan-African issues. But more time, people are just educated to go to the city, get your money, and then later on they, you know, grow into the kind of people that are frustrated with the community, as I was when I was younger. They just feel like, oh yeah, it's just a bunch of, you know, people that don't want to improve their situation. And the real issue is that there's a culture of low expectations, and there's people that just want to be baby mums and baby. And you're taking some of the stuff you observe and you're just drawing causality, where it's like, you need to know the science of this. You need to be sure that you really understand the nature of this problem, not just regurgitate whatever you can see with your eyes. But that takes a certain educational journey, in my opinion. Doesn't have to be in school, but yeah, it's an educational journey.
No, that's powerful. And I think, you know, you sharing that for me on a personal note really highlights or really gives testament to the work that I'm doing, especially around like my podcast, because it's like the guests that I've had on it's the community. It's me going back. It's me saying, oh, you're from the ends. You're a social worker. You're a mental health worker. Or, you know, you work in this area. Come in and share your expertise. So we, as, you know, a community, can learn together. And the fact that so many people have, you know, engaged with the content, not only within the community, but so many people outside of the community as well, engaging with that content, has been so powerful. I wanted to ask as well.
Yeah,
you spoke briefly about identity, and that transition of going into Cambridge. How was you able to maintain the identity of, you know, I'm still the London boy, I'm still here from the estate, I still have my experiences and whatever else? Because from the outskirt, anyone that doesn't know you and they just seeing you from Cambridge without knowing your context, they're like, all right, cool, he's one of those guys. He's the Harry Potter types.
Yeah.
He's, you know what I'm trying to say? You got your gowns and whatever else. How was you able to maintain your identity, maintain that authenticity? And did you ever have periods where you felt like, oh my God, I'm at risk of conforming?
So the first thing I didn't do was, I tried not to be scared. I didn't, like, I remember, she's my wife now, but back in the day, she was my brethren. We were completely platonic, and I told her I was going to Cambridge. And she made a little comment, I think, to her dad about, he's going to come back different. He's going to come back talking crazy. I've got to remind her about that. But I wasn't worried about that. I knew fully who I was. I was where I was. I stood in that wherever. And where I was from, in my actual neighborhood, I already had a bit of, I had to not prove myself, but I had to stand on my square quite a lot because I was so different from a lot of what was going on. And I knew, I believed in what I was on. I believed that I'm trying to get this education. I'm trying to bring it back to the hood. I'm trying to elevate the consciousness. I'm trying to contribute to our culture as well. These times I was a rapper. Now that's also a very important thing. So firstly, I didn't really fret too much about who thought I was real or what. Like Tupac said, man, I didn't have no patience for anyone that doubted me them days there. But differently, as a rapper, that was my link to the community, to the culture, when I couldn't physically be there. My secondary school was far. It was Quay compared to my everyone else. Everyone else kind of went to a local secondary school. I had to travel 1.5 hours to get to my school, innit? But I grew up as a grime kid. So even when I wasn't in the neighborhood, I was developing as an MC outside of school. I would always find my peers. I would always find people that were into the same culture. And that made me feel sane. That made me feel like I wasn't falling out of sync with what I really loved. So by the time I get to Cambridge, it's like a continuation. But in Cambridge, where there weren't many people from the same cultural context as us, I started connecting with African Caribbean societies in different schools, ACSs. They started booking me for poetry, not even just poetry events, but talent shows and these kind of things. And I write about this in my book as well. I swear to God, they held me down. Like, for the first year of my career, all the bookings came from Black students. So I'm now connecting to a much bigger network. And because I've switched over from rap to poetry, it's like I've just unlocked a cheat code because it's still the same level of lyricism and effort and really the same frustrations, the same pain that I was carrying from my teen years when everything, if you know anything about Northwest 10, my area of London, some of the problems have been a bit public. So these problems are very personal to me. Nowadays it's all in rap beef and everyone talks about it online. But to us, it was personal. And it's just sad. There's a lot of sadness. So I'm channeling that into my poetry. And Black people across the country are feeling me. You understand? So to be honest with you, I won't downplay it. That really helped me feel culturally rooted and culturally relevant in a way that I hadn't felt before.
No, that's powerful, man. That's powerful, man. And off topic, you said you're a grime kid. Who were your that's the era that I grew up in, innit? So who were you locked into? Like, who were you listening to and saying, yeah, like, this is it?
Yeah, I knew you would understand. When you said you're 34, I thought, yeah, this is my pupils. The Movement, of course, Boy Better Not, like, my number one of all time was Getz.
Yeah, for sure.
Skepta was very influential. We used to listen to them. Southfields, PDC. Where are you guys from?
I'm East London, Newham. So I'm Getz when he was in Nasty Crew. You know what I'm trying to say? I'm Big Seek and, you know, all of them.
Guys. All of that. So, yeah, you lot did a madness, man. Like, East London, Newham. Of course, yeah, like, and then our generation, all the Criminals and the Rottens and the Voltage, Brutal.
100%.
You know, it was the work rate was higher. See it there. So now, going back to your question, yeah, the reason I highlight that is because the culture, artistic creativity kept me whole outside of formal education. That was a missing piece that I think a lot of our parents obviously took for granted. Most of our parents didn't know what was going on. But us as the new generation of parents, we should be mindful that, yeah, like, the media will always frame it as black boys into crime and trying to, you know, do road. And yeah, to an extent, there is a lot of that. But look at what came out of the grime scene, bro. You know, look at how the UK not only respects man now, but how the world has been influenced. Like, New York's, the Pop Smoke wave all came from UK, from grime, really.
You see it in Australia, you see it in France. And guys are making, they're living off it.
Yeah.
It's not like it's like I'm making ends meet from what a culture has started. Yeah, that's crazy.
It's ridiculous. So my name is not known because of Cambridge. It's not known because of Queen Elizabeth Boys, my secondary school. Shout out to those institutions. They gave me a lot, but I made my name off the culture.
Yeah. No, that's
powerful. And the skills that the culture taught you.
That's powerful. I wanted to know as well, like education beyond the qualifications, beyond, you know, the certificates and, you know, the sort of graduations and stuff like that. Why is education so important to you, like, beyond the classroom? Because you spoke earlier about like independent learning. Like, how important is that to you? And how do you educate yourself without actually saying, you know what, I'm going to sign up for this course, I'm going to do another 3-4 years at uni? Because that's what sometimes people think education is. They think it's just having to go and do another course for 3 or 4 years. But what does that independent learning, you know, look like for you?
I would take it down to the basics of what education is supposed to do. Education is supposed to make you function better in the world. Right. Now, the reason why it's important to continuously educate yourself is because the world keeps spinning. Yeah, every 24 hours is one spin. That means that history is developing, new dynamics in the world are emerging. Right now, we're in the era of AI. Who knows what is going to change? Who knows? And a lot of us are sitting ducks. We're about to be victims to some of these changes. It's very important that you're not always on the back foot, that you kind of start reading the world like a book. Education is the training for that. Education is gym for that. You understand? When you try and understand something, you are developing your ability to read the world. Just one thing. You don't have to start off trying to understand everything. Me, I was trying to understand why the black community... First, I was trying to understand why my community was the way it was. Then I was like, rah, Northwest is the same as East, is the same as South. Let me try to understand why the whole of the hood is the way it is. Then I realized the way our story has progressed in my neighborhood is similar to what's happened in Compton, Kingston, parts of Lagos, Atlanta, Chicago, just the breakdown of leadership, the breakdown of conflict resolution. So all the time, Yannick, I'm trying to understand the same thing, but at new levels because of new developments. Chicago drill came out. I wanted to understand how it got to that level where you had Chief Keef at 16 talking the stuff that he was talking. And then everyone that came after that, the whole Chirac drama and tragedies that came out of that. Mm. I'm just trying to understand this one thing, but it now taps into a lot of other things. That's what's led me to read about housing discrimination. That's what's led me to read about black capitalism, the sabotage of the black American enterprise after the end of slavery, and how that relates to the sabotage of African independence after colonialism. It's all linked up. Mm. So because I'm trying to understand this one thing, just like training, like physical training, I just need to start sharpening. You know, like that, like when you start training, you might be working on your endurance, and then you want to work on strength, and then you want to work on fighting, because it's all the same. It's like, how do I get better at dealing with the world?
Yeah, that's powerful. Yeah, no, that's very powerful. And I wanted to sort of go back into something that's been really very sort of prevalent within, you know, recent discussions within education, and that's looking at the curriculum and what we're taught. A few months ago, I did an episode with Jeffrey Barche. Jeffrey Barche and Lavinia Stennett, who leads the Black curriculum. Honestly, amazing people. And we were talking about, you know, what it means to decolonize the curriculum, and I was just thinking, you know, in the general context of you know, students going to school, like, we don't have any say or any autonomy in terms of what it is that, you know, we're being taught. And I wanted to know for you, like, what do you think, like, the long-term implications of that are, when, you know, there's a system who are basically saying, this is what you need to teach, you know, children, and this is what's going to decide basically their level of academic excellence based on what we tell you, you know, that you need to teach them. And for you, what does decolonizing the curriculum, the curriculum mean to you as well?
The long-term implications of a colonized curriculum are that a small class of so-called educated people will leave behind the masses. Now, that class who come from the masses, they come from the working class, or they come from formerly colonized nations. The small class of people that get access to this education that is colonizing their minds, they will be used to snake out the masses. They will be used to say, I could do it. Why can't everyone else? My secret was hard work. Everyone else is in poverty and is in problems because they don't want to work hard. There is nothing wrong with the system, the way it works. The real issue is individuals that don't want to work with the system. That's the function of a colonized education system. I told you my grandfather went to Oxford in the 40s and 50s, in the 50s, I think. Yet, for all the education he received from them, he wasn't able to, and he was a solicitor general, then an attorney general. He was like the top lawyer of the kingdom. But he wasn't able to sidestep all the sabotage that was set in place from the so-called independence era. None of us are. Because a colonized education is not supposed to equip you to do that. A colonized education is supposed to get a small class of us to make the system look diverse, make the system look equal. And if we fall for that, what we're going to end up doing is explaining away our individual privilege and ignoring the structural disadvantage that this system keeps in place.
Yeah. No, thank you. That's a powerful, you know, that's a very, very powerful statement. And I wanted to move on and and sort of reflect on something that you was mentioning earlier that sort of come back to my mind, and you was speaking about like the power of like your poetry and the creative work that you've been that you know you've done in the past and continue to do. And I wanted to know from your perspective, like how can we use like the creative arts of like music, poetry, drama as powerful tools to educate, you know, young people and deal with some of the societal issues that, you know, we face, you know, in society. And I say that to say that I was speaking, I saw a sort of friend, colleague of mine, Vivian, who's, you know, she's a musician and does like, you know, creative work, and she's also done work in the past in the clinical field, in psychology. And I saw that she was delivering like some creative music workshops in that field. And I thought, oh, you know what? That's like so cool. I've just known the usual like art therapy that, you know, that clinicians do. But to have like a creative music workshop and all of these things, I thought, you know, that's a breath of fresh air. So I wanted to know like how impactful are those creative tools to, you know, educating young people and addressing like societal issues.
Thank you, Yannick. And this is where I go back to the grime years. This is why I'm trying to explain that my education was two parts. It was what was happening in the classroom, and it was happening what was happening in the community, on the roads, in the studio, in the park, on the bus. Yeah. In the grime years, we came up with something. Well, you lot in East London came up with something, yeah? And that thing spread organically. Mm. In that wave, we learned to organize ourselves. We learned to invest in ourselves. We learned to promote ourselves. We learned to talk and build bridges across communities. No one else was going to come and do that. The government wasn't trying to do that. And most people didn't, outside of our world, didn't really know how to talk to us. But music is its own language. Music's its own system. So when me and you, on different sides of the city, both heard Getz, we knew he was the truth.
Mm.
Because it's a whole different knowledge system. It's a different form of understanding. It's a different language. You understand? So it's not surprising that your friend Vivian is able to do workshops around creativity from a psychological perspective, because I do believe it's one of the most slept on things, especially with regards to Black consciousness and Black liberation. People take it for granted. People feel like, yeah, rapping is just, you know, or making beats is just something that young people want to do because they don't really want to work. But it's work. Of course it's work. Like, it's hard. It's hard to do this thing and cut through. Forget the money for a second, but to resonate with strangers, that's very difficult. But you're able to do that because the frequency that you tap into when you use creativity, art, music, it is transcendental. It's higher than, it's a higher form of engagement than reading a textbook.
Mm.
I tell you that from my heart. Everyone knows that. But because it is not institutionalized in a way that makes it seem part of our intellectual development, and because it's marketed for purely financial purposes, it is undermined and it's undervalued, which is something that we need to actively fight.
No, that's powerful, man. And I think the way you speak about it really makes me sort of look at that generation and what we were doing through a different lens and a different perspective. Like, I can look back and think, even songs like On the Block, how you get all those men from all those areas to link up to shoot this video that, if you look at it and, you know, you're thinking the megapixels are crazy right now, everyone linked up, and for 2-3 summers in a row, it was like, yo, we're just wheeling up, you know, this tune. And even for the ones that, you know, did MC from young, and you mentioned like Brutal and Griminal early, and they were fam, and we all went to the same school, and we was in the studio, and I used to see Brutal create his studio from scratch, and you're an engineer.
Yeah.
We're in school, and you're an engineer. Like, you know, you're doing all of that, or you're helping us write lyrics. What do you mean 8-bar, 16-bar? Like, how do I flow with that on the track? Or now we're doing bridges. Now we need to... So, like, the creative juices are just, like, flowing.
That is higher than a GCSE. Mm. That's higher than a degree. That's a real-life qualification. That's now transforming the way that your whole community, your whole demographic works. It's different. It's different, but I'm so passionate about making people understand what it really is, because people see a bunch of black boys and they just assume that they're just avoiding responsibility. But we're embracing it.
Mm.
This is difficult. This is high level stuff. Do you know what I realized that really made me think about this differently? You know what you just described, yeah? Brutal, the wave, all of that. If a government agency received tens of millions to bring us together, to put together tunes like On the Block or Rep Your Ends or whatever, they would fail. People win grants to do that kind of work and they can't deliver it because it's hard.
Yeah, it's just crazy to see the way that's elevated now. The way that's elevated now, and like you said, you know, people know you now because of the culture, and people know, you know, all of, you know, whether it's the chips, the gets, the D-double, because of the culture. And it's the culture now that has them doing ads with Old Spice, or has them doing, you know, X, Y, and Z. It's for nothing else, you know, but it's for the culture. And we're seeing that with, you know, with AG and what he's been doing as well. He's bringing back that culture. Right. He's bringing back that community, you know what I'm trying to say? And we're seeing that a lot with AG and what he's doing. So, you know, bringing that culture together. So, yeah, that's just been beautiful. Beautiful to see. So we're nearly finishing off, and I wanted to ask if there's one thing that you wished the older generation like had told you about identity, education, or belonging, like from when you was a young, and like what would that be? If there's one thing that you look back and you think, oh, you know what, I've had to learn this a different way. But if there's one thing that I wish the older generation would have told me about identity, education, or belonging, what would that be?
I would say don't stop. It's not like when you're born, you're given your identity and that's it. It's not like the culture that you're from stays the same and that's it. You just got to learn the rules and stick to the guidelines. It don't stop. Every generation, you have to define your identity, you have to define, and you have to define culture for yourself. That's why, if you notice, every generation's got a different way of talking.
Mm.
You know, like, even in the ends, like, older men, like, especially in East, older black men had a certain Cockney twang.
Mm.
We, in our generation, we don't have that. But then Gen Z have a slightly different way of talking from us. They've got different slang. Me and you will say the ends. Them and their young kids, they never say the ends. They say ends without the dirt. Mm. It's a little different, but what it is that every culture is being iterated. So we cannot afford to be passive. Millennials, a lot of us millennials, love Beyonce and Jay-Z.
Mm.
The new kids are now in an era where Beyonce and Jay-Z are so clear that, you know, like, you look at them kind of differently. Both of you lot are from communities where nothing has improved, really, throughout your whole success, your whole career, your whole run. And you're out here buying $30 million cars and showing us things that are not relevant to liberation. So it is on us to iterate the culture differently and say, you know what, we're not going to rate the celebrity thing too tough if we don't feel that you are really invested in the progress. If you don't measure your success by a raised consciousness of the community and increased opportunity and a real struggle for liberation, if that's not how you're measuring your success, then we don't rate that. We have to think proactively about the flaws of whatever we inherited. And we got to work really hard to make the situation right before we leave.
Yeah.
And that comes down to what you believe your identity is.
No, that's powerful. That's powerful. Wanted to ask as well, as a parent, what does education look like when it comes to parenting for you? Is there anything that you maybe taken from, you know, pops and mum, and you're like, oh, you know what, like I'm definitely gonna be like this? Or do you feel like, you know what, let me just learn as I go? Like, what are the key things that, you know, you really want to push within your children, especially when it comes to education beyond the classroom?
I just want to ensure that my children thinking about how they grow, you know, and as they're seeing mommy and daddy growing as well.
Mm.
Like, it's a continuous conversation. Like, I can hit my dad right now and just ask him anything, and he'll give me some insight that he wouldn't have been able to give me 20 years ago, 15 years ago. You understand? So I really do believe it's like, you got to think of it like one endless conversation with your child. Don't make them feel like it's a crime to not know something or to make a mistake. Don't make them feel like your love is only depending on whether or not they can meet certain expectations. Just make them know that you're here. Do you get me? And whatever you're going through, like my parents didn't know nothing about poetry or entertainment, but they were willing to learn with me. And that's just something that I want to continue with my children.
Yeah, that's powerful. That's powerful. And, you know, you're someone that's, you know, really, really connected to like your community, to your culture, not only, you know, in the ends, not only in London, but back home in Uganda as well. How important is that to you, like remaining, you know, connected with your roots?
Yeah, that's a must. That's a must because, like I said, as a generation, we have to define the times, and we will get spun if we don't know, if we're not able to connect our lives with our ancestors. You get spun. There's no other, if I just can't explain it any other way. Like, me being in Uganda right now is only because I've been making an effort to take myself here for the past 15 years. Yeah, it wasn't just natural. It wasn't like I didn't just know the roads and I didn't just know how to engage with people, but I've been trying to build that month by, like, 1 month at a time every year. And what that allows me to do is bring my children to an environment where they're able to see African children, not through the lens of the West and through the lens of poverty or conflict or whatever, just in their element. We go to the supermarket, they get to see black couples, African couples holding hands, making decisions for the household. You understand? So it just normalizes a certain expectation for them. And it makes them feel connected to this thing. And it makes them know, like, no matter what they try and tell you out there, this is who we are.
Mm.
This is who we are. And you have a stake in this. And you have a responsibility to make sure that the future of this thing goes well.
Yeah.
That's what I want to show them.
No, that's powerful. That's powerful. Thank you, man. Thank you. And I think that's, you know, that's a very good place to sort of close off. And, you know, I just want to thank you so much for making you know, the time to join us on this episode. And I think, you know, this episode in particular is a real, you know, testament to for me on a personal note, a real testament to like the progress and the effort that I've been making with the podcast, because one of the things that I do, like when I get ideas, whether it's themes or particular guests or whatever, I write it on you know, my to-do list that's titled, you know, Habakkuk 2 verse 2, which, you know, in scripture says, like, make your plans, you know, plain and write it down. And somewhere on that note, yeah, is like, cool, like, I need George on this. Like, I just wrote it, George question mark. And there's so many other people that I've written so-and-so's name question mark, and some of them have come into fruition, and some of them, you know, have not, but the name's still there, because I know, like, you know what, you're going to keep working, going to keep pushing, and the fact that, you know, we're coming to me having, you know, this pod, or having the podcast for a year, which I'll be celebrating this month, I feel like it's a real, you know, testament. And these, you know, conversations are important conversations, not only for our community, but for the communities that are looking in and saying, okay, like, this is what we're doing. We're now understanding the context. You know, we're now understanding the context. We're now understanding the roots, the foundations of which these, you know, these men, these women are coming from. So that when we're looking at their experiences, it's not just, oh, you know, he's a senior person within a local authority in London, and, you know, he's an educator and he's good. But let's look at the wider context. Where did I come from? What have I experienced? And I like the anecdote that you gave right at the end when you were speaking about your children looking at you and mum and saying, you know, identity is not linear. We're always going to change. And mummy and daddy are learning too. And I think that's the same with all of us. Like, we're all going through that journey of learning. And I've learned so much, you know, from this episode as well. So thank you again for, you know, for coming on. Appreciate it.
Hey, man, it's a pleasure, bro. Thank you so much. I think there's so much overlap in what we've been through. And it is a privilege to be able to just document it. And like you said, make sure that within and outside of the community, it is known, you know, what we went through and what we tried to achieve. So thank you very much for all the hard work that you're putting in, man, bro.
No, I appreciate it. So thank you again. That has been the Too Cool for School podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to our YouTube page and follow us on our social media platforms. Thank you.